Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. I'm your host, Kevin Kennedy. Today is Memorial Day, May 26, 2025. I hope everyone's having a great Memorial Day weekend so far. We have a fantastic show lined up for you, starting off with Glenn Wright, the adjutant for the local American Legion Post 14 here in Park City. He'll speak with us about today's Memorial Day activities. Then we get to speak with Disabled American Veterans National Commander Daniel Contreras about the ways they support the veteran community. And we'll speak with Michael Foster, the farm manager over at Copper Moose Farm. The farm stand over there is opening on Thursday, and he's going to tell us what he has going on over there. We'll finish up our hour by replaying an interview with Matthew Harris. He's the chef over at Tupelo. Well, good morning. We're joined by a special guest, Glenn Wright, who is the adjutant of... Did I pronounce that correctly?
Adjutant. That's correct.
Of American Legion Post number 14. You know Glenn Wright. He was in politics for us. But post number 14 is right here in Park City. And how many members do you have, Glenn?
We have technically about 38 members.
38 members. Is that a big membership or a small membership?
Statewide, it's a relatively small membership.
Gotcha. And who is in the American Legion? Who's allowed to join?
Anybody who served in the military during times of war.
Okay. Actual war declared by Congress or police actions?
There are specific periods of time that Congress has decided that we were at war.
Gotcha.
And that includes basically the war on terror started on 9/11 and continues to today.
Okay. So anyone in the past 25,
yes.
24?
Yeah.
Oof. That is fantastic. And what do you all do over there?
What do we do? Primarily two things. We've been running the Memorial Day ceremony at the cemetery on Kearns Boulevard for many years. And we also have a beer call for veterans on Veterans Day. And we give out scholarships to Park City High School for essentially for community service.
Okay.
Because we believe that the American Legion is a group of people who have given to the community.
So now I understand. So the ceremony over at the cemetery on Kearns, what time does that begin?
That will begin at 10 o'clock, although we will actually have patriotic songs sung by the troublemakers starting at about 9:45 as people are arriving at the cemetery. And the event will probably run about 20 minutes or so, 20 minutes to 30 minutes.
Gotcha.
We'll have the honor guard from the sheriff's department presenting the flags. Mayor Worrell will be our keynote speaker. She is also a Vietnam veteran. She was a Navy nurse during that period of time and took care of some of our wounded coming back from the war. And I'll introduce her and have some following comments. When I've run this in the past, I usually ask the people that are there, who are you here to remember? If anybody who particularly wants to remember somebody that died in service to their country. And I'll have a couple of stories of actual people.
Wonderful. And now, is there parking?
Parking is relatively limited there, as you know, the cemetery. The roads there are fairly narrow, but you can park along the roads in the cemetery. If you live close enough, walk. It's supposed to be really nice on Memorial Day.
Yeah.
Walk, bicycle, take public transit. There is a bus stop right outside the cemetery.
Glenn, what would be your message to the listening public about the importance of Memorial Day? Why do we commemorate this day?
Well, you know, there's a saying amongst the veterans community, all gave some and some gave all. And this is the day we honor the folks that have died in the service of our country. And actually, this particular day, in the last, about 7 weeks, we have passed several significant milestones in American war history. 50 years ago on April 30th, the Vietnam War ended. 80 years ago on May 8th was victory in Europe in World War II. 160 years ago, I just looked this up, on April 9th, Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, essentially ending the Civil War. And April 19th was the beginning of the Revolutionary War with the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And in that regard, I have a quiz for you guys.
Here we go.
I'll give you a hint. It has to do with one of those four events. Who are these names associated with? John Brown, Samuel Handley, Caleb Harrington, Jonathan Harrington, Robert Monroe. Isaac Muzzy, Asahel Porter, and Jonas Parker.
Civil War.
Roger, you have an idea?
The John Brown sort of takes you to leads you to the Civil War.
Yeah. Actually, they were the first Americans to die in war for our country at the Battle of Lexington. Lexington and Concord.
Yeah. That story, for those who don't know the details of that story, it's not just a war, it's how they put the lanterns up in the North Church, mm-hmm. and that the British actually saw it and were heading to Concord, Concord or Lexington had
Lexington was first. Concord was the storage that they were going after, where supposedly the Patriots had stored their weapons. They fortunately, due to good intelligence on the part of the Patriots, not good intelligence on the part of the British, knew they were coming. They did remove a lot of those materials, and they were ready for them.
Yeah.
And in that battle, 49 Minutemen died, but somewhere close, I think, 180 Brits died, mostly on the way back to Boston.
Okay. We've been talking to Glenn Wright. For those of you who are listening, once again, that memorial service will be taking place at the Park City Cemetery just a few minutes from now. Troublemakers will be singing starting at 9:45. The ceremony itself will start at 10. Glenn, thanks for joining us. While Memorial Day is technically a day to honor those who have died in service to their country, it's also an appropriate time to think about the needs of those who have made a different kind of sacrifice. We're joined this morning by Daniel Contreras, the National Commander of Disabled American Veterans. Good morning, Commander, and thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having this opportunity to talk about our organization, but also just something that is, I would say, important to all veterans and the community to understand the sacrifices that our veterans have made.
Let's talk about, let's set the stage a little bit. How big a population of veterans does DAV serve?
Proud to say that DAV has nearly 1 million members, but veterans and their families do not need to be members to access our free programs and services. So more than 1.1 million veterans trust DAV. This is with their claims work, and so they give us their power of attorney in order to represent them for their benefits and have received in this population more than $30 billion in earned benefits.
So of 1.1 million, what percentage is that of all veterans?
That's a great question. 18 million, yes, it's a very vast population of veterans. So if you look at, in general, DAV has a great impact on the veteran population. Yeah.
So only about 6.5%. So all the others can take advantage of your services that are offered to them.
Absolutely.
Well, let's get that out there. What is the definition of a disabled American veteran?
Well, with us in our organization, it's gas wounded or injured or diseased during a wartime period. And that's where our membership eligibility lies. But in thinking about that, it's something that, we're an organization of inclusion, not exclusion. So we would like to have an opportunity to evaluate the needs of that veteran, because a lot of times, well, let's look at California, 1.5 million veterans, and less than 35% are receiving benefits. And so outreach is such an important aspect, because that knowledge of knowing whether you're entitled or not is something that I think just having the opportunity to evaluate and to have an understanding of your entitlements is really the key.
So let's talk a little bit about you mentioned the sort of definition of what disability means, but let's take it down a level. What's the range of physical and mental disabilities that you see in our veteran community?
Well, as we defined it, there's really just such a broad scope. So every veteran has their own unique military experience, and it can lead to various disabilities. If we look at the post 9/11 veteran or Vietnam era, those who were in combat, these explosions and other accidents in combat, but also in training, they can lead to traumatic brain injuries, more catastrophic amputations or burns or paralysis. And then you think about some of the hidden disabilities like post-traumatic stress disorder or military sexual trauma. And from the aspect of the horrors of combat, these are the hidden aspects of things. And when we talk about training, you look at, fatal vehicle accidents or just even injuries from that enduring the grills and the aspects of what you go through, those are also possibilities. But we can also look at the Vietnam veteran with Agent Orange and some of the presumptive conditions that we can help veterans kind of explore where possibly their benefits. And the latest advent, of course, is burn pit exposure. And we're finding that more and more veterans of the post 9/11 generation, and even in other eras, have experienced this aspect of burn pits. And, you know, one of them was related to, you know, 3 football fields in length of a burn pit. And imagine being around that and all the toxic exposures, cancers and other diseases that can transpire from that exposure.
No, so the VA obviously provides some services to veterans. What are some of the gaps that DAV needs to fill in terms of needs of veterans? So, you know, if someone's a veteran, they use the VA, what would be the impetus to go to the DAV for something extra?
Well, first and foremost, especially when we're looking at a climate of claim sharks and individuals who are trying to take advantage of veterans and representation, DAV's National Service Program represents claimants, establishes new claims, reviews and develops the records, and assists in appeals. And so in 2024, DAV service officers filed over 560,000 claims, and that was for over 1.5 million specific injuries and illnesses. And the other aspect of it is after service. What do you do? And so employment, entrepreneurship, so nearly 100 traditional and virtual career fairs are held by DAV just last year. And so since 2014, nearly 350,000 attendees received nearly 200,000 job offers. And so DAV even expanded that program even further in helping veterans. And what about our veterans who have their own business models or want to explore how to become entrepreneurs? And so we established the Patriot Boot Camp, and it connects these entrepreneurs to mentors and education programs. And one of our latest and greatest initiatives has really helped as far as getting that connection and giving veterans an opportunity to expand on so many aspects of what their skill sets have been built on their military experience. But we also have our transportation network, and our core of volunteer drivers give free rides to veterans to and from VA medical appointments. And these rides might be the only way that they can get to and from their medical appointments. So in 2024, our volunteer drivers spent over 580,000 hours providing over 235,000 rides. And this is logging more than 9.3 million miles.
That's
so
fantastic.
You look at, since the advent of our program, more than 761 million miles have been logged to provide 20 million rides.
So I'm visualizing something like a pie chart in which I can see a major piece of what you do is facilitating access of veterans to the benefits to which they are entitled by the VA. So that's a big chunk of what we just talked about. And then the next pieces are these other programs that we've been just talking about, sort of facilitating transportation, job fairs, entrepreneurial support. Am I sort of seeing what you guys do in a reasonable way?
Absolutely. And from that, there's always just this, what can we do? What is something else that is really in the abstract of how can we help veterans, but not just veterans, how about their families? DAV was very instrumental in legislative work on caregivers, identifying these hidden heroes who really do so much to help out veterans, where if you monetize that, it would be in the billions of dollars that have been saved by VA. So we helped in legislative work to get that done. But DAV has even taken it further with our DAV Caregiver Support Program. And so this is an interesting statistic. According to RAND, over 14 million Americans provide daily care for wounded and injured and ill veterans every day. And so what our program has done, it opens this up to caregivers. And so it's an online resource. They do some risk screening to better understand someone's role as a caregiver, and then we provide digital tools to support their caregiving responsibilities and provide them with a personalized care plan and a one-on-one support person, our care specialist, and they will actually communicate with that care specialist specifically the whole time. And it aligns them with the sources that they have in their own locale. So that makes it more independent, but they need respite. They need help navigating, just that red tape of insurance, or just need somebody to talk to.
And what is that website, please?
So that would be DAVcaregiversupport.org, and they can look into that program, and it's free. You know, and so it's really, and again, I want to emphasize that this program is not just loved ones helping veterans, but what about veterans who are helping loved ones? So we have taken, like you said, where do we fill the gaps? Well, we fill the gap on that caregiver initiative that we help loved ones who are helping veterans, but also veterans who are helping loved ones.
So how big a problem is veteran suicide? And do you guys have programs to try to look at that?
Absolutely. This is one of DAV's most critical policy goals. And if you look at 2024, the Veteran Suicide Prevention Annual Report, it highlighted the complexity of suicide within the veteran population. And it notes that between 2021 and 22, there was an increase in male veteran suicides and a reduction in suicide amongst veterans women. But it's a significant decrease in suicide among the subpopulation of homeless veterans as well. But when we look at, there were over 6,400 deaths for an average of 17.6 veteran suicides per day, and of which 7 per day were among veterans who receive VA healthcare. So what does that tell you? That tells you that those who are not engaged in clinical services are more apt to commit suicide. And so outreach, again, is such an important element. But what does DAV do? We have a charitable service trust, and it's on the front line of suicide prevention. And it finds and it funds programs and organizations that get effective results in saving veterans' lives. And so we're talking about initiatives like Save a Warrior or Boulder Crest Foundation or Reboot Recovery. And so DAV supports this through our charitable service trust. And so it also has our DAV members and also collaborates our volunteer services and mentors with this program. So earlier this week, we were proud to announce our support of a $1 million grant to Boulder Crest and its post-traumatic growth program. And this ensures veterans and their families have access to those necessary resources to live full and meaningful lives in the aftermath of trauma.
So you had mentioned homelessness. Does the DAV have programs to assist those who are homeless to get themselves shelter and continue into a job and such like that?
Well, it's a tragic realization because across the country we've definitely seen a growth in the homeless community. And so homelessness and housing insecurity remains a major concern for DAV, and this is at all levels. And it's an issue impacting communities, as I indicated, nationwide. So DAV and VA have made significant strides in addressing this issue. I would say that more than 55% reduction since 2010, there still is a lot that needs to be done to ensure every veteran has access to stable housing. And once again, you know, we can give a great deal of credit to our DAV Charitable Service Trust and Columbia Trust. And it provides funds to DAV homeless veterans initiatives. And this promotes partnerships and collaborations at all levels of government. So when you're talking about homeless stand downs, and this is to help with homelessness and housing insecurity.
Okay. Obviously, as an organization, DAV is very attuned to the way in which government supports the veteran community. And every politician talks about how important it is to support those who have made sacrifices for our country. But let me ask you, what changes in the level of government support, if any, is DAV advocating?
Well, always working with different administrations, when we get engaged with our critical policy goals, we know that there are changes in Washington. And so let's just talk about the veteran itself or that service member who has been impacted. So the journey from injury to recovery It can't be completed until all veterans are able to find meaningful life and regain purpose after the injury or illnesses. And so, you know, occupational impairment is a key element when talking about disability benefits. So for those who are able, working to care and provide for themselves and their family is a fundamental principle of that transition. And so if we look at the Congressional Budget Office, veterans without a disability rating earn $62,400 on average. And veterans who receive VA disability benefits had an average annual earnings that were 16% or $10,200 less than those of veterans who did not receive those benefits. So, of course, providing adequate funding and permanency for veterans, we're talking about employment and training programs, because as we know, you know, give a man a fish and they'll eat. But if you teach them how to fish, and that's what the programs do, if we're talking about vocational rehabilitation or we're talking about an opportunity to provide them with gainful employment, meaningful employment, and they can not only take care of themselves, take care of their families. And so we're really engaged in making sure that we protect veterans from employment discrimination when they're receiving health care for service-connected conditions, because a lot of them will avoid going through that process because they feel that it's going to preclude them from job opportunities. So
yeah,
there needs to be an improvement and reform federal programs for disabled veterans and entrepreneurship. But lastly, we need to continue to support veterans' preferences in public employment. This is important because that's just that extra little bit of a leg up on a veteran having an opportunity, because they've already served our country. They've sacrificed a lot. A lot of times you don't have where their skills within the military can translate into the job program. But when you think about veterans in general, I mean, they're on time. They are structurally, you know, grounded because of the policies and adherences and leadership traits that they have. They are an excellent employment choice because they bring in these characteristics and ethics with them. And so we hope that having just that little bit of a preferential opportunity would give them just a little bit of a leg up and show that, you know, we appreciate the services that they have provided.
Yeah, yeah. So as we wrap up, what would you say to a veteran who is possibly thinking, hey, you know, everything's okay, but maybe I need a little bit of help? Like, are there local offices that the veteran can go to? Like, you know, we're right outside Salt Lake City. Is there an office in Salt Lake City they can pop into, say, hey, this is what I'm going through? What can I do?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. I think first, you know, we look at where they can find just that starting element, and that's at DAV.org. And at DAV.org, you can look at all the subcategories of ways that we can help in claims work and voluntary services, or we have our local veterans assistance program. So if you want to volunteer, or if you need something, just a little bit of help in and around the house or anything like that. But I think it's really important to understand is that we will help them navigate these processes and free of charge, because we have to really emphasize that we are veterans helping veterans, and we are skilled and able to navigate those processes with them so they can find either gainful employment or the services or medical needs that they may have that are unique to them because of their illnesses or injuries or disabilities in general. But also the family dynamics come into play, because I mentioned our job programs that we have, our job fairs. Well, this is also open to spouses as well. So we're constantly thinking about the family, because that is always the concern of a veteran as well.
Outstanding. We just spent a few minutes with Daniel Contreras, the National Commander of Disabled American Veterans. Daniel, thank you very much for your time. If you turn down Old Ranch Road off 224, you'll see Copper Moose Farm and Farm Stand almost a mile down on the right, just across the road from the pond at Willow Creek Park. When the Farm Stand is open, they'll have lots of fresh fruits and vegetables available. Michael Foster is the farm manager and here with us to tell us about the farm, the Farm Stand, and what's available at Copper Moose Farm. Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Right on. Hey, so how long have you worked at the farm?
I am entering my fourth season at Copper Moose Farm, And this is my first season as the farm manager there, and I'm thrilled to be in this position.
Outstanding. And wait, how long as a farm manager? First
season, okay. Correct.
So what's a farm manager do at a place like that?
Wow, that is a great question. I feel like that is an expansive question. You know, I am in charge of everything from the crop planning to determining what vegetables are planted in our fields to picking the flower arrangements that will be in our bouquets. I am the point person for all coordinating with members of the community and the questions that they have for the farm, really just across the board of, you know, all things farming and all things admin at the farm.
So basically you do nothing.
Exactly.
Holy yeah. cow, that's a lot.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Does the soil tell you what to plant?
Partly. We do run fertility tests in the fields every season, and we make adjustments for our fertilizers based on that. We are in our 18th year of operation, so we have a pretty good idea of what our fields need and when. And we have a pretty rigorous crop rotation schedule, which essentially means that when veg gets pulled out of the field one season, that following season, we will place a certain crop in that area based on the nutrients that either takes out of the soil or gives back to the soil.
Okay, so some plants give back to the soil.
Oh, yeah.
What's...
Definitely. Probably the most common plant for increasing soil fertility is the pea, just the standard pea. That could be a sugar snap pea, a different variety of pea. But legumes in particular capture nitrogen from the air and fix it into the soil, which all plants need certain amounts of compounds to grow, but all of them rely on nitrogen. And so if you can do a crop rotation that involves a lentil, then you are setting yourself up for a successful crop the next season. In theory, there are a bunch of different variables that go into that, but that's how we think about our crops, of what crops need what and then what was in the soil the season before.
You know, for those of us who think food comes from the grocery store, the complexity of what you're talking about is really pretty interesting. Now, do you have an academic background in this, and are you constantly monitoring, you know, for soil, for chemistry, for all these kinds of things in order to maximize, you know, the productivity of the farm?
That is a great question. I personally, my academic background is multifaceted. I went to school for environmental studies in both my undergraduate degree and in my master's degree. And throughout both of those schooling periods, I always found myself on farms, whether it was volunteering, whether it was working, whether it was just showing up and seeing what I could do. My agricultural journey started in Eugene, Oregon, a really lovely spot to learn about agriculture and to grow within this space. And for many years, about a decade, I just found myself bopping on and off of farms and loving what I did and loving what I was doing. But as far as the actual academics of soil science and related fields to growing food was not always the primary focus of my degrees. Now, about 6 years ago, I said, I love this so much. This is what I want to do for my life. And that's really when I grabbed onto agriculture as a livelihood and started doing deep dives into the different layers of soil science and microorganisms in the soil, and really understanding how this field, it is an understanding within myself that this will be a pursuit of perpetual learning, of always understanding how earth systems influence the soil influences bugs, bugs influence the plants, and on and on and on and on.
Oh, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Truly.
Let's take a typical day. Let's take a typical summer day. It's mid-July, let's say. Walk us through a typical mid-July day, please.
Yeah, great. Mid-July, waking up at 5 a.m., getting some stretching in because I know I have 10, 12 hours of hard labor ahead of me. Walking over to the farm, I'm very privileged to live on property. I'm the on-property tenant at Copper Moose Farm, and I will start with a field check, which means making the rounds on our entire 3 acres of looking at all the different crops in our outdoor fields and our indoor buildings, assessing what's going on with the plants. How are they looking? Do they look healthy? Do they look unhealthy? If they look unhealthy, what type of decisions do we need to make to either bring them back up to health, or if there's something such as a pest infestation, do we need to actually pull them out of the field so that pest doesn't spread? So every day starts with the rounds of checking the fields and the crops. And then if it's July, then we're going to move into our daily harvest, which means about like 3/4 of the day is taken up by harvesting crops for sale the next day in our farm stand. And then the final quarter of the day would be doing general maintenance, such as pruning tomatoes or cucumbers in our greenhouses, weeding crops in our outdoor fields, doing the watering rounds.
Big days.
Big days, long days, and lots of love. It's a labor of love.
Nice. So you said it's 3 acres. Is that the growing area, or is that the whole farm?
That is the growing area.
Okay.
So we have 3 acres in production for vegetables and flowers. The greater property is bigger than that, but the farm itself, the land on what we grow on, is 3 acres.
You also have greenhouses. How do those two interact?
They are mutually supportive. Mm-hmm. Our greenhouses are year-round production facilities. So in the winter, we grow a variety of salad greens in our greenhouses. We have a small winter online market that we do produce for over the winter. But in summer, our greenhouses, they have the crops that do not thrive well in this climate inside. So those are our tomato plants, our pepper plants, our certain flower varieties, eggplants, and these are the crops that love very high heat and get baked in there over the summer to flourish and to produce those fruits that would not grow in Park City over the summer because of the varying temperature day and night.
So do you, what do you have planted now or planting now for this summer? Since we're talking about crop rotation, what can people see in the farm stand this summer?
In the farm stand this summer, you will see a whole variety of vegetables that are in flux with the season. So constantly throughout the summer, or consistently rather, you'll see salad greens, arugula, head lettuce, turnips, radishes, and then at different times of the season, so July, August, you'll see a whole bunch of tomatoes and cucumbers. In August, September, you'll see a lot of summer squash, so zucchini, patty pan, squash such as that. And then come September, October, it's going to be radishes again, beets, different root crops. Carrots are one of our bread and butter crops. We have that from about July through the end of the season, which is end of October. Yeah, everything's kind of in flux, and we are at the whims of Mother Nature. So if we have a colder spring, that means some crops will be pushed back to harvest later. If we have a warmer spring, then that's earlier. It's really in flux, and if you're interested, you can always stop in and ask us in the farm stand what's going to be available in the next week or two.
And it's now, we're in early April. There's still snow on the ground in some places, but I think it's mostly going to be gone by next week. You're going to be putting things, are you already putting things in the ground?
Oh, yeah. So we've had garlic in the ground since last October. That's a long growing crop, so that sits in the ground over winter. And we have our first outdoor sowings planned for April 15th. And what that means is we'll get direct sowing crops. So we'll just put a seed into the ground. in a couple of weeks here. Those are our salad greens. Those are our, that's our arugula, our carrots, our beets. But then we're going to be taking our starts that we've already been growing for 1 or 2 months and plopping those in the ground starting at the same time moving forward.
So how many people work at the farm?
We have 5 full-time seasonal employees, and that means our crew comes on at the end of April and stays through October, and then 2 full-time employees through winter.
And are they all experienced farmers, or is there on-the-job training?
A little of both.
A little of both. You know, we, our crew are generally folks who have a strong desire to learn earth systems and to be involved with plants of some kind. Backgrounds definitely varied, very strong, determined personalities to work long days under the sun, manual labor, but...
And for a tough boss.
For a very tough boss, exactly. Got to stay on schedule, putting down the hammer. No, we always say at the farm that, you know, there is agriculture is romantic, you know, being around the plants, listening to the plants, understanding the interconnectivity of earth and plants, but it extends far beyond a romanticism because you're getting your butt kicked for 10 hours a day. I always say it's like bending over for 9 hours, carrying 50 pounds at a time each and every day. And but we lift each other up and we have a very strong connection and unite over this love of growing food.
Okay, is the farm stand open all year round?
It is not. Okay. Our farm stand opens for seasonal operation on Thursday, May 22nd. And we are open on Thursdays and Saturdays through the season. Thursdays, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and Saturdays, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And that will be our normal operation from May 22nd through October, weather dependent. Outside of this summer growing season, we do offer a weekly online store. So the farm stand's not open, but you can still buy our veg. And if you're interested in that, you can go to our website, coppermoosefarm.com, and there is a link where you'll enter your email address and get on our mailing list for that weekly winter online market.
Nice. And are you guys on Instagram or any of that stuff?
We are. We also have an Instagram. You'll find us at coppermoosefarm_, and you can follow us in real time there.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners?
Thank you for the support.
All right. No,
we've been doing this for a long time, and we couldn't do it without the support of Park City community, and we love what we do. So just a huge thank you and appreciation for everybody listening.
Yeah, one last question. Was that property a farm back in the day?
It was not. It was a creek bed.
Okay.
So in our buildings, in our outdoor fields, what we do a whole lot of is picking rocks, stones, and boulders out of our fields. Uh-huh. Very fertile soil, but filled with rocks from a creek bed long ago.
Long ago. How about back in the mining days? Was it a farm then?
I will need to follow up with you on that. I'm not exactly sure if you go that far back. Not that I know of, but I will do some research and follow up.
Okay, we've been speaking with Michael Foster, the farm manager of Copper Moose Farm. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
After a short sabbatical from Main Street, Tupelo is back serving up delicious classics. This time they're over on Kearns, but still helmed by Chef Matthew Harris. Joining us via phone is Chef Matthew Harris. Good morning, Matt. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. So let's start with the Today Show that you shot on Friday. How was that experience?
Oh, the Today Show is fantastic. Those guys are great to work with. You know, it can be a little nerve-wracking traveling to New York and getting up here and thinking you're on, NBC that's seen by millions of people. But those guys are just such a good top-notch group, and they really take care of you. So it's always a super fantastic time to go to the Today Show.
Nice. And how's everything in New York?
It's great. You know, I'm going to admit it's a little bit colder here than it was back home when I left. I wish that we were getting a little bit of this weather, honestly.
It's a wet cold, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a wet cold, but it was nice. Windy, but can't complain overall.
Cool. Now, how did the whole Today Show happen?
We were back in September when we were actually all the chefs from Park City that attended the Beard Foundation. We actually had it scheduled then, so I'd have been in New York already. Excuse me, but that got postponed, and they called us back, and they were like, hey, you know, what do you think about coming in around Christmas time? Would that work for your travel schedule? And we you know, being just right on the cusp before ski season start, I was like, yes, we can do it. We can squeeze it in. So it worked out great. So we were originally supposed to go back in September, but this turned out even better.
Outstanding. So. I love it. So now Tupelo. Run by, you and your wife run it, Maggie, and you correct. Originally opened on Main Street in 2015?
Correct, 2015, good. On at 508 Main. Yep.
Perfect, and a short sabbatical down in Midway, and now you're on Kearns, over by Wells Fargo, yep. On the corner of Monitor. How many seats do you have there?
We have over 100 seats there, so it's on one floor, so it's comparable to the original Tupelo that was on three floors. We did have quite a few more seats at the old Tupelo on Main Street, but it really works out for us being on one level. It seems to be easier to monitor and control and be guest interactive there when you have everything on one level. So it's, you know, I can't say it's working out great.
Excellent. And how many diners can you accommodate in a single evening?
Oh, several hundred.
Nice.
Yeah, several hundred. And we do often, definitely during the winter season and peak season. So
nice. And now you're a highly trained chef, as far as I know. Some big names in the culinary arts you've worked with. Are you able to mention your favorite?
Well, I have a couple of favorites, and thank you for saying that. You know, I don't know how true it is. I appreciate that. I definitely worked with some greats out of Atlanta early in my career. Kevin Raspin, Pano Caritasis, you know, they're big restaurateurs in Atlanta. And how I got to Utah was by John George, who is a big chef out of New York, was opening at the St. Regis, and I was the original chef that was opened the St. Regis there. I since have, you know, after opening Tupelo, have actually gone back to the St. Regis as a and opened up those concepts there as well.
And good deal.
So I operate Rhyme, Brasserie, 7452, and La Stalina there.
Well, do you get any time on the slopes?
I do, you know, it's super important to me. So I make time early in the morning to get out for sure.
Nice. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I do love some skiing.
Good. Now of all the dishes you, presently serve at Tupelo, what's the hardest, what's the hardest one to make?
You know, the real thing with, Tupelo is we try to keep our dishes super kind of straightforward, ingredient focused, and simple to prepare. If I had to pick one, I wouldn't say it's hard to prepare, but I would say it probably has the most layered ingredients would be actually the one I did on Friday with the Today Show would probably be the beef and barley, which has been it's been a definite classic and a mainstay at Tupelo since the opening, actually.
Wow.
It's just, it has a lot of technique to it. Not a lot of ingredients, but a lot of different cooking with the sauce and the barley risotto and stuff like that. And the way that we also cook the meat. So
yeah, risotto is an experience.
Yes. This is a barley risotto, so it's a little bit of difference, but it's a slow cooking process. So
nice.
That one I would probably say is the most complex.
Good. And what's your favorite?
Oh, that's going to be a tough one. I'm going to be fearful to answer that one because it changes from season to season, to be completely honest with you. I could go from one thing one season, and it'd be on the menu for a while, and then that kind of change. A really good go-to, honestly, is we do that main crab fritter, and this has also been on the menu for a really long time, and we've actually brought it back in our classic category on the menu, which we added several months ago, where we revisit a lot of the classics that we've done over the years and put them on the menu. But that one, it would be probably the crab fritter with hot sauce, butter, and house pickles.
Oh, I'm dying here. It's
a little bit of bar food. You know, you could enjoy it with a crisp glass of wine or a beer, and it would go perfectly with both.
I love it. I love the fried chicken, the elk bolognese. Are those old classics?
Those are classics, and that we kind of saved the chicken, to be honest with you, really for the locals. Not to put anything against the tourists, but what we usually only put that fried chicken on the menu during the summer for the locals.
Oh, okay.
And then it comes off during the wintertime. And we put other dishes. The elk bolognese tends to stay on the menu all the time. That's a local and a tourist favorite.
Absolutely.
That one is definitely a classic. It's a very go-to ski hearty dish. So it stays on there most of the time.
Yep. I was going to say that. After a day of skiing, that elk bolognese, boy.
Yeah, and it's the elk sourced from a great farm down in southern Utah, so it's a local product. The mushrooms come out of the Salt Lake Valley, so we're really proud of that, keeping our focus where we're trying to use as much Utah product as we can there.
And you also have a farm, is that correct?
We have a little small farm in Midway. It's on the same land that we live on down in Midway. And we produce tomatoes, squash, Swiss chard, collard greens, all out of that little stretch, as well as some carrots and radishes and things like that out of that little section of land. And we produce that all summer long. I mean, I can't say that we produce all the vegetables that are on the menu at Tupelo by any means. In conjunction with some local farms, Wrestling Aspen or Lindsay's Farm, Gracie's Farm out in Wanship, we've really, during the summer, we're really, really heavy with just produce right around there. Yeah, we do produce a good bit out of Midway, but we still use a lot of other farmers with other stuff.
And do you care for the farm yourself, or do you have some people helping you out?
So I do most of it myself, as well as Maggie helps out a lot. It's a good educational piece. So we have people down from the restaurant as far as cooks and servers and stuff that like to come in and just educate themselves about where the food comes from. So we use it as an education tool as well.
So now Tupelo, we all know it from that song. And we also know it because it is a phenomenal honey.
Yes.
Are you a beekeeper?
I'm not a beekeeper, but the Tupelo honey is a very, very unique ingredient, and it's not something that is always around. It depends on the season, and I think that's really where the name came from. We want to emphasize that we really take care in the selection of products that we use and the food that we buy, and so the name kind of embodies the whole brand and the whole focus and how we source food, which in my opinion is the most important part about cooking, is the ingredients that you are cooking. You can try to do a lot of stuff with bad ingredients and you can get by with it, but it's much easier to spend some time sourcing really good ingredients and making those shine.
So Tupelo is down south. The trees are down south, and so you have the southern flair to your food, and Utah's the beehive state, so appropriate.
There's definitely a conjunction there for sure.
I love it.
When we came upon the name, we were like, yeah, that just fit.
Now, how about the wine list? How's your wine list?
So we have an exceptional wine list. We've had a Wine Spectator Award since 2016. So, well over 300 bottles, give or take, the time of year that you're in. So we have a pretty in-depth wine list.
Outstanding. And desserts?
Desserts, we offer 3 to 4 desserts daily, and those change daily.
Oh, wonderful.
I wish I could tell you Yeah, I used to tell you some of my favorites, but those are always rotating and elevating and coming in and out, depending, especially upon the season.
For a locals tip, don't give your favorite trail on the mountain. Give your second favorite so you can keep your favorite to yourself.
Oh, you know, let's see. It's going to be hard to say, you know. Are we talking mountain biking or skiing?
Oh, geez.
Skiing.
You're after my own heart. Yeah, which one?
Wow. Yeah. Well, let's go skiing. I mean, I'm probably going to have to say Stein's Way.
Okay, good one.
Yeah, I love that. I love that run. It's challenging. Then it lets off, and then it's challenging again, and it's long, and that's probably one of my favorites.
And you'll be hitting that later this week when you're back in town.
I sure will be.
Favorite mountain bike trail?
Probably Sparrow.
I'm over at the Canyons. I'm a big fan of Ricochet.
Ricochet, yeah. Yeah, I probably have ridden that one. I don't recall it. I get down to the Canyons every now and then. I usually stay up in Park City just because it's really close from the restaurant for me to just dip up there for a couple hours.
Outstanding. And anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Thanks for listening. I appreciate y'all hearing us interview and talk, and look forward to seeing you guys this winter.
Now, how can
come
they
in and say hello?
Yeah, how can they find, do you have a website for the restaurant?
Yeah, it's TupeloParkCity.com.
Wonderful. And how would people make reservations? Do they call or they do one of those online things?
No, you can go straight to the website, TupeloParkCity.com, and there will be a reservation button, or you can go to Resi.com.
Okay, we just spent a few minutes with Matt Harris, chef of Tupelo over on Kearns. Matt, thank you very much. I hope you have a successful winter.
Great. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money Podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.